Hello, this is the podcast for our class on November 15, and it was class number 23, and we talked about defenses here. We actually finished up the notion of affirmative defenses. All that means, saying an affirmative defense, is that the defense to the cause of action isn't I didn't do it or I didn't meet those elements. It's either I did it but you did something too, or there's something outside of this that removes me from contention. I'm not going to be held negligent because of some outside legislation or rule, but some rule or legislation removes me from liability. So, and some of these defenses, particularly in assumption of risk, may apply to other causes of action besides negligence. That just depends very much on the jurisdiction. Can you assume the risk of somebody's intentional tort? You know, questionable. But the book does talk about that, so you can review that. We had talked about assumption of risk in the last class. We talked about express assumption of risk. Those are the waivers, the releases. What those do is remove the defendant from having a duty of care. I just release you from any, you know, duty on your part. And then we talked about implied assumption of risk, primary implied assumption of risk in the sporting event arena. That is either participating in a sporting event or participating in the sport or going to a sporting event. Can you have impliedly assumed the risk of that's inherent in those sports? And the courts will say yes. Why is this important? Because the old version of assumption of risk when contributory negligence was a rule in all jurisdictions was that if you assumed the risk, whatever, you were then barred from action. Contributory negligence was a complete bar. So assumption of risk was a complete bar. Now, under comparative negligence, the big question is, does assumption of risk still have any role under comparative negligence? And we've seen that, yes, it does under, there can be valid waivers or releases, use the Tunkel factors. You can, assumption of risk, the primary implied assumption of risk, that is, participating in a sport, yes, it still has a role. The big question is, what are the inherent risks of that sport that you are impliedly assuming just by participating? Big amount of litigation on what's an inherent risk in any of these sports, but in New York, it's still a complete bar to an action for negligence, even though New York is a jurisdiction that has pure comparative negligence. So the big question is, what about the secondary implied assumption of risk? That is, outside the sporting event arena, outside the sporting event milieu, can you, can you have assumed a risk in doing some risky activity so that it will be a complete bar to the defendant's negligence? Or is your doing this risky activity merely negligence on your part, something to be compared? Because, of course, we can see that you want to be just considered negligent. You want your activities, your whatever you're doing, to be not a bar to your recovery. You want it to be not relieving the defendant of a duty of care, but just negligence on your part. So this Cotton Hope case talked about that. You know, we had somebody who he knew about the stairs were unlighted, but he continued to use them time after time. And yes, inevitably he fell down those stairs and was injured. No doubt that the managing agent was negligent in not putting the lights, you know, not replacing the lights, not making the lights better. Question, even though our defendant, our plaintiff knew that it was risky to go down those stairs, should he be considered negligent that in continuing to use the stairs, or just relieving the defendant of a duty because he kept using them even though he knew that there was it was risky? And the court here says assumption of risk, and they lump everything reasonable and unreasonable together, is just negligence. And if we're in a comparative negligent environment, assumption of risk, if it's negligence, you know, the secondary assumption of risk is just negligent behavior, and it just should be negligence to be compared with the negligent behavior on the part of the defendant. It should not be a complete bar. If you're in a pure environment like in New York, you're always going to be able to sue. If you're in one of these modified, like South Carolina was, you can sue unless the jury considers you to be not more negligent, you know, considers that it was not more at fault in this accident for continuing to use the stairs than the landlord was at fault for not replacing the bolt. So the takeaway is that unlike primary implied assumption of risk and express assumption of risk, which continue to be bars to an action for negligence, comparative negligence just subsumes implied assumption of risk, the secondary implied assumption of risk. It's just negligence on the part of the plaintiff to be compared, because the courts say once we've adopted comparative negligence, the harshness of contributory negligence should be abandoned, and your dopey behavior is just to be compared with the dopey behavior on the part of the defendant. So implied secondary assumption of risk is not going to be a complete bar, just negligence to be compared with the negligence of the defendant. We moved on to the firefighter's rule, which many, many jurisdictions still have. It's been eliminated by statute in New York, but the firefighter's rule is still alive in a lot of our neighboring jurisdictions. Like we have the Connecticut case. And all the firefighter's rule says that it's basically sort of assumption of risk. If you're in a risky profession, that you are assuming the risk inherent in that profession. And the firefighter's rule is really based on premises liability and says if you are injured on somebody's property by the dangerous condition on their property, you can't sue if going onto that property was part of your ordinary job in either fighting the fire or performing your service activities as a police officer. You can't sue the property owner for negligent conditions on their property that cause your injury, because those are, you know, inherent in your profession. The property owner should be protected. They didn't have a chance to, you know, you're going on in an emergency situation. They didn't have a chance to inspect and make safe and all of those other things that we are looking for property owners to do. In Connecticut, they talked about that Connecticut still had their classifications, and they said, you know, we can't treat police officers and firefighters as invitees to guarantee them that the property's been inspected. Can't treat them as that because they're there on an emergency basis. Firefighters' rule also says, you know, property owners pay their taxes, and their property taxes, they're paying the salary, and so it would to have a liability would be just like double taxation. And that injured firefighters and police officers are entitled to workers' comp, and that should protect them sufficiently. Clearly it doesn't. Here we had in the case of Lewandowski, they had probably three times more damages than workers' comp would give them. So they were suing this defendant who had been involved in a criminal activity for negligently bringing the police officer who was chasing him on to, you know, a neighbor's land in the dark. And the court said, well, it was foreseeable if you're running out in the woods in the dark that there's going to be dangerous conditions. And but for our defendant running around in the dark on the property, our plaintiff wouldn't have been injured, all of that kind of stuff. Question here was the defendant wanted to assert the firefighter's rule right off the bat, saying, can't sue me because you were injured on property during your job. The court says that the defendant cannot assert the firefighter's rule because the defendant wasn't the property owner. It's a property-based rule. It's premises liability. None of the reasons for the firefighter's rule, the double taxation, all of this stuff, none of those reasons fit when it's not your property. So the court doesn't question the firefighter's role, but says it has to be limited to being asserted by the property owners. Then we moved on to another defense, a very special one, preemption. That is that a federal law or state law preempts suing in state common law tort action, so that the law, either impliedly or expressly, compliance in that law, either impliedly or expressly, preempts any state court tort suit. And we see this all the time in pharmaceutical cases. We see it in environmental cases. And this case, the Geyer case, was a safety statute mandating, talking about safety requirements in automobiles. Or the defense is, I complied with this safety statute, or if you're a pharmaceutical, I complied with the warning label statute, I complied with the everything that that the statute did, we complied with it, and so we shouldn't be held to a state court coming along and saying, well, nonetheless, it should have been safer, or the warning label should have been more clear, or the or that you can't sue because the statute has said you can't sue. So the idea of preemption then is, when does compliance with a state or federal statute or regulation preempt bringing a suit in state court? And the courts say it can preempt it if there's an express preemption provision in the statute. It can preempt it. So look at the statute itself. Or maybe it can impliedly preempt it. Look at the legislative intent. The legislative scheme is a state court suit consistent with the legislative scheme. In the Geier case, they found that there was a preemption clause, and inconsistently, so our plaintiff says, a savings clause. That is a clause that says this doesn't, it doesn't mean that you can't sue in state court. That's a savings clause, saves it for save state court actions. But the preemption clause says can't sue under any other kind of safety standard. And here our plaintiff wanted to say they should have been had side airbags, even though the statute didn't mandate it. They should have had side airbags. So the court here tried to figure out, did the statute intend to create a minimum safety measure so that they still could have sued, saying it should have been safer, or did the statute intend to create a maximum safety measure? And by looking at reading this, they couldn't figure it out from the statute, so they started reading Secretary of Transportation's memos, very, very going out on a limb there, the memos from the Secretary of Transportation saying that it was deliberate that they didn't require airbags, that they were phasing them in. Such a new technology, they were phasing it in. So the Geier case, it's been controversial that it went outside the face of the statute, looked at legislative intent, and actually looked at beyond the intent of the legislature, looked at the Secretary of Transportation memo. And you can see that from the, if you read the dissent, a unholy alliance of Justice Tom, you know, the most conservative and the most liberal justices, the most conservative saying, you know, states' rights, federalism, the state should be able to make their own laws, and the most liberal saying, we can't bend over backwards to have to interpret a statute in such an anti-consumer way. So preemption, though, is at the heart of many of the biggest tort litigations today, because it's always asserted by big pharmaceutical companies, conglomerates, manufacturers, the biggest of the big, as a defense, saying we complied with the legislation, that should be enough. The legislation should preempt any state court actions. So preemption as a defense is at the heart of some of the biggest amounts of litigation these days, and something to be followed. Okay, so next class we're going to leave negligence entirely and talk about brand new causes of action. First will be strict liabilities for some kind of activities, not acts, but activities.